This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 8th of February 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where this week we're asking, how do you draw the news? A picture's worth a thousand words, they say, so how do political and topical cartoonists drill down into the core of a news story, a scandal or a cover-up to reveal its essence? And how do they transform the news, so often the home of badness and sadness, into a place where it's okay, in fact it's recommended, to laugh? To lift the lid on how to accomplish satire in pictures, then, we'll speak to cartoonist Nick Newman, whose work appears in the Sunday Times, Private and The Spectator. How does he do what he does all day?
You rejoice when there's a big political scandal. Mm. You know, that's what you're in business, to hold up our leaders to ridicule. And when they're doing it themselves, it's, you know, all the merrier. Thank you very much to MPs everywhere for being so greedy and venal.
We'll speak to Ellery Mae Harris, the Australian who did the seemingly satirically impossible and turned ISIS into a comic strip. And we'll end up in Lebanon, where getting caught being funny can land you in the slammer. It's set to be a fascinating half hour that'll attempt to answer the question, how do you draw the news? And it is Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Stay tuned. So first of all, let's meet Nick Newman, cartoonist for Private Eye, The Sunday Times and The Spectator here in the UK, a satirist who's lampooned the trials and tribulations and silliness attendant in politics, popular culture and sport for decades. Newman is an avuncular master with a wry touch for spearing the villains of the day. In this weekend's Sunday Times, after a week that saw a major malfunction of British Telecom's internet service, we giggled as the boss of BT Broadband told his secretary, "I'll be writing to apologise to customers because it's quicker than sending an email." So what's Nick Newman's working day like? Does he ever suffer from a flaccid funny bone? What are the subjects he just loves to lampoon? Here's Nick Newman.
I started off unbelievably early, at about the age of 16, selling cartoons to a yachting magazine called Yachting Monthly.
Ripe for satire always.
Oh, absolutely. There are so many political gags in yachting. But by the time I'd sort of finished university, I was a bit more clued up on what was going on in the world. And although I initially started working as a journalist, as a business journalist, I was sort of beginning to do topical cartoons rather than political cartoons. And that's really been my focus for the last 30 plus years or whatever.
How did those things kind of come about? Are you more interested in, the topicality, whether it's across sport and politics?
Well, being actually pragmatic, there are very few slots in national newspapers for political cartoons. Mm. The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Times are all completely sewn up. So if you're a political cartoonist, you're going to struggle. But as a topical cartoonist, there are a lot more outlets. You can do stuff for Private Eye, for The Spectator, for Prospect. I also work for The Sunday Times, and I'm their sort of main pocket cartoonist, as you might call it. So that's sort of...
Two-foot Nick Newman, welcome to the programme.
Exactly. It's all about size. If you can draw small, you're probably more likely to get more stuff published than if you draw on a gigantic scale.
So this is part and parcel. People will know your work. It's pretty much always portrait rather than landscape, isn't it? That's the way that things work. Yeah. And that is, I suppose, being pragmatic. Your creativity works within that box, and you've become used to that, I guess, that little straitjacket.
They're very similar sort of disciplines in that you're trying to take topical events and set them in a slightly sort of bizarre cartoony world. The mainstream political cartoonists do much the same. Peter Brooks would say that he does it exactly the same sort of things that I and my colleague Matt on the Daily Telegraph do, but he says, "I just do it bigger." That's his view. I mean, he's very, very funny, and he's a superlative draftsman, so he's slightly selling himself a bit short. The great thing about being a pocket cartoonist or a topical cartoonist is you don't have to have that amazing ability to get a likeness. I mean, I can just about get a sort of thumbnail likeness. I do a cartoon strip for Private Eye called Dave Snooty and his chums. And thank heavens I can draw Cameron just about. But it's not essential to the job. What is essential are jokes, and you've got to be able to come up with lots and lots of jokes.
I mean, this is obviously one of those things where you have a funny bone or you don't, and you have good days and bad. And part of factoring in being funny into your day job is an intriguing thing for people to hear about. What is your daily routine, Nick?
I have different deadlines for different days, yeah. I work for different publications throughout the week. But generally, for, say, the Sunday Times and Private Eye, it's a question of, as you say, poring through the newspapers, taking lots of notes, trying to sort of think laterally about, for example, Lord Lucan, yeah. Was he eaten by a tiger? And then you think, well, what other things might have been eaten by a tiger? So I did a joke yesterday yeah. about the Chilcot report, but linking it to the Lucan story. And it's often trying to sort of marry up sort of different things, but really just to surprise people, I suppose. That's one of the most important things about being a cartoonist, the element of surprise, doing and things that other people haven't thought of.
Is the acid test, whether it makes you laugh, it's got traction in Private Eye or the Spectator?
The acid test is whether you sell it or not.
Okay, right, yeah.
No, I'm a cartoonist. I'm a very bad judge of my own stuff. I tend to generate far more cartoons than actually get published. So for every one that I get published, I'm probably thinking about six ideas, which is quite a good discipline because it makes you think a lot harder to try and just generate the material. You will be doing a cartoon about Europe this week, a year from now, yeah. 2 years from now. You know, the jokes pretty much stay the same. And so you can often just sort of tinker with them a bit to try and freshen them up.
Do you get a sense when you send your sort of drafts to the editor that it's the part of their morning that they enjoy the most, without wanting to give you a big radio hug here, but you know what I mean? There's a lot of crap they must have to deal with of a morning. That must be a nice sort of, not diversion, because it's obviously part of their job, but
in my dreams, I think some editors are extremely nice about it and say they really do enjoy going through the gags. One or two make it feel like mental torture, and you can go, I've worked for various editors where it's a bit like dying as a stand-up comedian. It doesn't mean to say that they won't use your stuff, it's just that they, you know, editors have a lot of stuff going on in their brains.
You don't get many superlatives back in the email, maybe.
No, okay. I think the collective noun for cartoonists is a whinge of cartoonists, because we're always moaning about not just money but the joke blindness of editors.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, we're enormously grateful to everybody who publishes us, but sometimes it can feel as though you're sending stuff into a black hole.
Yeah, you create a zinger and it comes back with yes, please.
Yeah, or we'll just not quite.
Oh, right.
That was always the Punch thing when Punch was alive.
Yeah.
You'd send in half a dozen ideas and think, oh, these are the best jokes you've ever done. And they come back saying, not quite.
What are your sort of evergreen subjects? It sounds perhaps like you have an ear attuned to certainly sport and maybe especially cricket within that. There are evergreen political topics like Europe and all the rest of it. But other things that you sort of can't wait for something to come back into the news because you've got such a sort of surfeit of, well, you've got a funny bone attuned to that particular political or topical thing.
I mean, you rejoice when there's a big political scandal. Mm. You know, that's what you're in business, to hold up our leaders to ridicule. and when they're doing it themselves, it's, you know, all the merrier. I mean, the expenses scandal was fantastic. Yeah. You know, when once you're doing cartoons about duck houses and
they write themselves.
Oh, yeah. It's just, you know, thank you very much to MPs everywhere for being so greedy and venal.
And you mentioned the collective noun for cartoonists, which is a whinge of cartoonists, doing yourself down there, of course. Nice one. Does it feel like a sort of collegiate environment to work in? Because it must be pretty competitive at the same time.
We're always very pleased to see each other, and we don't, because it's a very sort of rather lonely and lonely profession, particularly now with the internet. You tend to work at home or in a studio. So when we do get together, it's always good fun. And basically, it's just trading notes about how depressing the world is. I love cartoons, and I love to see other people's cartoons, and I'm always tweeting gags that I enjoy. And there's a certain amount of jealousy when somebody's beaten you to a great gag. But no, we call each other brother brushes.
Brother brushes. Yeah. I like it. Is that kind of going back in history with that sort of fraternal idea as well? I'm thinking maybe this all starts with Hogarth. But I wanted to ask you about Crookshank, because you put together, you've put together a radio play that you've written. That'd be fantastic to know a bit about that.
Well, it's quite interesting from the historical perspective compared with what we're all up to now, what they were doing back in the early 18th century. I've written this radio play, which is going out on Radio 4 at the end of the month, called Trial by Laughter. And it's about a bookseller and a pamphleteer called William Hone, who was worked alongside Crookshank, and Crookshank often illustrated his pamphlets. And he produced satirical attacks on the government of the day, and particularly the Prince Regent. This was in the period of the Regency. In the course of doing this play, which is a huge amount of fun, he was tried on three consecutive days for three different things, and was, well, you'll have to find out, listen to the play to find out whether he gets away with it. But basically, Hone established all our principles of free speech and the freedom of the press in this one series of trials. But during the course of the trial, he produced a lot of cartoons, particularly by Crookshank and his predecessor, Gilray. And doing the research for the play, it's startling how much more scatological the cartoons were then. They were much more vicious, actually.
Yeah, because I think about Gilray and Crookshank, especially about the Prince Regent. They were sort of masterpieces of grotesquerie.
Yes, and the Prince Regent was drawn as a corpulent voluptuary, and you see him there sitting there with his big belly and his waistcoat undone and his flies undone, and in the background you see this chamber pot overflowing with ordure. And actually, in today's newspapers, I don't think you would get away with that kind of sort of viciousness, really.
I guess one of the points of great cartoons is the sort of laser beam accuracy by which they can satirise a piece of news or a person in the news in two lines and one drawing, rather than a huge long, thundering editorial, I suppose. Do you get a feeling, whether it's studying Crookshank or whether it's the impact of your own work, of whether they leave a good or a bad taste in the mouth of those pilloried, I wonder?
Well, certainly with Crookshank, it left a very bad taste in the mouth. Mm. And eventually, like his colleague Gilray, the Crown got so fed up with him that they actually bought him off and gave him a big fat pension to stop drawing the Prince Regent and his mistresses. And Crookshank basically became an illustrator, and that's when he ended up illustrating all of Dickens' works. So cartoons can make a difference. On the whole, I think satire doesn't make a difference. I think it may change people's perceptions of people, but cartoonists don't bring down governments. It's the people who bring down governments.
That was cartoonist and writer Nick Newman. Stay tuned, because after the break, we'll head to Australia to find out why the ABC have decided that a comic is the best way to tell the story of ISIS. And over in Beirut, we'll meet a group of artists who found the police knocking on their door after they tackled religion in their magazine.
Monocle loves books. We love them so much that we have our very own books team in partnership with our friends at Gestalten in Berlin. We've already launched the muscular and handsome Monocle Guide to Better Living and the Monocle Guide to Good Business, plus the London and New York titles in our new hardback City Guide series. And coming your way this summer are the giant Monocle Guide to Cozy Homes, that's packed with inspiring residences and practical advice, and City Guides for Hong Kong and Tokyo too. Monocle's books offer a world of new experiences between the covers, whether you're staying at home or seeking new adventures. See our full lineup of well-turned-out titles at monocle.com and on the shelves of all great bookstores.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Band, and this week we're asking, how do you draw the news? When you think about comics, it's probably fictional characters that come to mind. Superman, Wonder Woman, Tintin. Islamic State couldn't be further from the world of superpowers and superheroes. They're supervillains, surely. But it's this confronting topic that artist and journalist Ellery Mae Harris is tackling for the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the ABC. She works in the world of comic journalism and is using the medium to explain more about IS. James Viver went to her studio in Canberra to find out more.
I'm currently drawing al-Baghdadi's nose, and I am drawing a little flourish behind him. Oop.
Why do a comic about IS?
Why not do a comic about IS? Okay, so Islamic State have been covered everywhere. So many news articles about them, so many, you know, written pieces, so many radio pieces, so many just your daily news cycle stuff. No one's really done a comic about it. And this comic is able to take all of these different events that have taken place over time and bring them together in one place that makes them look like a unified story. And that's probably what this comic is going to give you that another story about Islamic State might not. I'm kind of using my line and my colouring choices and the types of images that I'm depicting to make you feel something. I'm not giving you a straight up report to explain the facts necessarily, although I am also doing that. I want to make you feel something. I want to make you think that you're in a particular place.
How much is this project art and how much is it journalism?
The story itself, there is nothing in the text that wouldn't stand up as a written piece by itself.
So what have been your sources then for telling this story?
I don't use sources that wouldn't be any different from someone doing like a radio news story. I do a lot of background research. So I do a lot of, for this particular story, I read a lot of books actually about Islamic State and where they came from. I trawled through the news. I watched heaps of stuff on the internet. I listened to interviews from correspondents who've experienced Islamic State. I have like folders and folders of images, and most of what I draw is based on an image that I've already seen, particularly for a piece like this, because I think it's important to be trying to replicate something that at least resembles what was really happening.
To be factual.
Yeah, to be factual, basically, yeah. I mean, that's why you spend so much time trying to figure out what they're wearing and what guns are they carrying, you know? Like, I actually spent a lot of time on military blogs and on the Wikipedia has a page of all the weapons they know that Islamic State has and that they use and they've been photographed using. So I drew those weapons into the comic. I spent literally days looking at photographs on the internet from, you know, bodies and Islamic State to explosions and Islamic State to researching what the flag looks like. What do they look like when they're, you know, getting dressed up? What are they wearing? I don't want you to feel like you're reading Tintin. These guys are horrible. They did terrible things.
Hi, my name's Matt Liddy. I'm the editor of Interactive Digital Storytelling with ABC News.
What do you think this comic is going to be able to do which other kinds of coverage can't?
So this seemed, you know, we've kind of had a goal for a while to dip our toe in the water of graphic novel storytelling. So we kind of tried to choose a subject matter in the Islamic State story that obviously was going to be continuing to be in the news. It was going to be continuing to be relevant and interesting to people. Probably they came out of nowhere about 2 years ago when they first kind of took control of the city of Mosul. And until then, most of us hadn't heard of them. Look, I hope what it can do is just provide people with that kind of background information that they don't get in the typical news cycle, and to get it in a format that's really accessible and easily understandable and interesting and engaging for them. It's really tried to capture the serious nature of the story. So, it doesn't shy away from the fact that this is a serious story and that it's a sometimes violent story. I think the look of the comic has been inspired by the subject matter. So there are elements of to the design language, there are elements to the artistry that are inspired by, I suppose, Middle Eastern and Islamic traditions. That really brings a tone to the piece that makes it very interesting.
In the first panel, there's an explosion, basically, and there's some people running away. And the image itself is based on a street image that we have from the city of Mosul. It is the US military blowing up a building full of money. So I don't actually have an image of the building that was blown up. I don't know where it was, but I'm able to use, you know, Google Images to find the right look. These buildings that I've drawn here exist in this city, and I don't know that that's where the bombing happened, but it's better than nothing, basically. The next two panels are basically decorative panels that have lots of text in them explaining what's happening in an Islamic style. In Islamic art, they use a lot of circles and, you know, the classic Arabic Arab style building point. Like that's part of a lot of decorative design in Islamic art. And I sort of have used that as a motif throughout. And I've used a lot of stars and crescents because those two things are really associated with Islam, including this really interesting star shape, which is a sort of like a square. And with another square, I think it's called an eight-pointed star. There's one of them there. I've drawn of quite a few of those in there. Every type of journalism has the hand of the person who's making it in it, but we can't see it most of the time. And we try and pretend that journalism is straight up, and this is how this happened because I have an audio recording of it, or I have a video footage or a photograph. But you're only seeing part of what the, you know, the journalist has sort of curated together to put up for you, you know. And one of the things I really like about comics is it's being more honest about that. You can see that I made this because it's hand-drawn. It's really nice that the ABC have decided to take on something like this because it's not usually something that a public broadcaster would do because of the concept, I suppose, of the emotions involved in something like this. But I think that it will be received well. I hope that it's received well. I hope that people get something out of it.
Comic artist and journalist Ellery Mae Harris there. The IS Explainer will be published online by the ABC's news division before the end of February. With the likes of Charlie Hebdo, we've seen what happens when cartoonists try to tackle religious subjects in Europe. But what about when they do it in the Middle East itself? One comic book magazine in Lebanon did just that and quickly found itself on the sharp end of the law. As we heard from Nick Newman at the beginning of the programme, cartoonists have been getting into trouble since the early 18th century. And this story brings that right up to date. Monocle's Beirut correspondent Venetia Rainey reports.
Picture this. It's 2007 and a group of Lebanese artists have started a comic book magazine. Samandal is the first of its kind in the region, and the idea is to provide a space for cartoonists from the Middle East and elsewhere in the world. It covers everything from the whimsical to the philosophical, and is quickly a success, going from strength to strength. Then, 4 months after Samandal's revenge-themed seventh anthology is published in December 2009, three of the four editors find the police knocking at their doors. One of the three, Hatem Imam, explains what happened next.
So basically we went to the police station, to the general security offices, and there they questioned us one by one individually. And it was really, you know, like kind of, you know, the stuff that you almost see in the movies, you know, they, you know, trying to intimidate you, people walking in and out of the office, asking random questions, threatening things, you know, like just throwing weird threats, and never, you know, for a very long time, not actually telling us what this is about. You know, they're just, you know, asking questions and being very rude and whatever.
Finally, it became clear. Two images from the 300 or so pages of their last issue had offended anonymous, but clearly powerful, local Christian groups. One of the images belonged to a strip analysing the literal meaning of a Lebanese idiom, which translates as, "I burn your religion." It sounds grisly, but it's used all the time here to show annoyance, and that was the joke. To illustrate this, one panel has a sketch of a tiny priest set ablaze. The other image was from a story about a Roman soldier who, covering up a gay fling, murders his lover. He blames the crime on members of a new religious sect who are duly punished Roman style. So the last scene shows him looking at a man on a cross, thinking, "You're the gay one." Risqué? Maybe. But hardly offensive if read within the wider context of each cartoon.
I mean, we thought that obviously that it was ridiculous, and we consulted with our lawyer, and we thought, you know, like if we present this in front of any judge, obviously they will see our point and they will realize that we had, one, no intention of insulting anyone, and two, that the comics themselves are, you know, they're not insulting to begin with, and there's nothing to be, you know, insulted about.
But the authorities did not agree, choosing instead to focus on the individual images and prosecute the editors. One of their legal team, Rana Sahia, explains more.
It's Article 25 of the Law Decree number 104. It was issued in 1977, so it's an old law decree. Article 5, it's about inciting sectarian strife. And many other things, but I mean, they were accused of inciting sectarian and religious strife.
The case dragged on for 5 years and was tried before three courts before the charge was finally, definitively upheld at the end of last year and a $20,000 fine imposed on the three men. Exactly which Christian organisation it was that flagged up the cartoons is still unclear, but a large part of the problem is that Lebanese politicians were so willing to support censorship on behalf of religious bodies.
But again, the whole case, which is very important also because here we see the mix between the politics and... The whole thing was initiated by a letter from the Ministry of Information to the Ministry of Justice. And the letter says that as a Minister of Information, I got a lot of reports from certain Christian personalities saying that they were not very comfortable about these comic stories.
Although complaints like these appear once in a while, traditionally, Lebanon is a bastion of liberalism in the Middle East, and in the past, similar cases have been thrown out by the judiciary. So what does it mean that such a slim suit against three young artists was so doggedly pursued? I spoke by phone with Ayman Mahanna, head of the Samir Kassir Foundation, who called it a bad sign.
I would say it's a very negative setback because so far, on many issues related to artistic freedom specifically, the courts were way more liberal than the media or the legislative branch or the executive branch. This is the first time, probably since 1998, that things go in the opposite direction, where the court doesn't stand with the journalists or the artists.
This said, perhaps the timing of the issue meant the result was influenced by similar events outside the country.
I think that if we didn't have the Charlie Hebdo issue around the same time that the court case was ongoing, we might have had a different outcome. But after the Charlie Hebdo developments, but at the same time, a little bit earlier, former President Michel Sleiman suggested that Lebanon would put on the table of the UN agenda the idea of banning anything that disrespects prophets and the most important religious figures.
While state censorship is a worrying development, perhaps just as dangerous is the fear and self-censorship that such rulings create. So, after 5 years and a cripplingly hefty fine, are the Samandel team going to think twice before they publish from now on?
On one hand, I don't care anymore about what people are going to say, like the general public's reaction is going to be, on one hand. And on the other hand, I feel that actually we will get a lot of support. Because, I mean, now we feel much more connected to our readers, to our contributors. There's a real, you know, like a much stronger sense of community that came because of this case.
Samandel may have set out to be apolitical, but when you talk about religion in the Middle East these days, it seems there's no such thing. Luckily for the region's satirists, the team isn't willing to give up just yet. For Monocle in Beirut, I'm Venetia Rainey.
Thank you, Venetia. So how do you draw the news? Like anything satirical, it's all about instinct, about finding the funny side of events. And drawing the news is also about being quick on the draw. Pun very much intended. It's quite a competitive place, the drawing board, so make sure you're tuned in at all times. There's no subject that's off limits. If you can imagine it as a picture, it really is worth 1,000 words. And what else? Getting into trouble might just be worth your while. And that brings us to the end of today's show. You've been listening to Culture. My producer was our very own Private Eye, Holly Fisher. Join me again at the same time next week. But for the time being, I've been Robert Bounds, and thanks for tuning in.